Welcome to the award-winning Disrupt Education Podcast, a podcast that explores the latest innovations and trends in the world of education. I'm your host, Peter Hostrasser, along with Allie Privet.
We're both educators. Okay, one of us is a former educator, and we were tired of the status quo and wanted to create a space where we could have conversations that aren't always in the public eye. Join us as we talk to other disruptors, educators, researchers, and thought leaders who are pushing the boundaries and challenging the way we were taught.
We're thrilled you're here to be part of a not-so-underground movement to disrupt and amplify the good pieces in education. Whether you're a teacher, a parent, or a lifelong learner, there's a story for everyone on Disrupt Education. We're here each week to bring you stories from all over the globe of people doing education differently.
So buckle your seatbelt, get on the disruptor plane as we climb to altitude before letting this episode free fall straight to your ears.
Welcome back to the Disrupt Education Podcast. Allie Privet, how are you?
I'm well. We are rocking and rolling. You're back at school.
Yeah.
I'm back not at school. Although, I will say, I'm actually, this is a new update for our listeners. I decided to kind of give back to the community and where I live and offer up my services to sub locally. I have not yet taken a job yet, but I'm like,
there'll be plenty.
There will be, but I'm actually really interested in what the experience is going to be like. And they're like, oh my gosh, you know math, you know science, you know health, you're like active, you speak Spanish. Like, when did you come into the school?
But you're like, and I know it's $500 a day for me to come in.
Yeah, but it's really interesting though. Like, just, you know, that being in the community that you live in, and yeah, the school system is such a big part of that. And I know that our guest today is going to speak to that importance. And I think for those who listen to the podcast, you know, disrupting education, part of that is also being part of the educational system that's in your backyard. And I'm excited. And I know I'll share updates as the year goes on, because that's like what we do here. But I just wanted to share that as the school year is starting and people are like brimming with, you know, that new year excitement. And, yeah, I'll be excited to see what a new rural school district looks like.
I think there's a podcast there as well. So we have Andrew Pass with us today. Andrew, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, 100%. So I could give you like a great big long introduction, but you know you the best. So I'm going to give you an opportunity here. Kind of tell people who you are and what you're doing now around education and life in general.
So I actually live in Detroit, grew up in Chicago, went to school in New York at Columbia University. And in October of 2009, I had met my significant other, Debbie, and we're still significant others. Borrowing money from my parents and substitute teaching and a project manager from Pearson Learning Solutions reached out and asked me to work as an instructional designer on a couple of courses for a proprietary institution of higher ed, ITT. So I quickly said yes and recognized that if Pearson wanted to work with me, then other organizations would probably work with me as well. And today we've grown into a healthy company and just having a good time developing customized content with an important why.
I love that. The customized content. I gotta ask about that. So, well, first off, let me ask you this. When you got started, like what do you think Pearson was looking at in you? How did they find you? You know, because we talk about our students and everybody in education being connected. How did that connection go? It wasn't like they just called you up out of nowhere, or maybe they did.
They did not. So here's what happened. So I had a couple of non-successful companies before I started APAS Educational Group. And one of my companies was going out of business, and I personally was looking for some work to do. And so I spoke to somebody who was involved in an association. And she said, you know, there's something called the International Association for Computers and Online Learning. And at that point, it might not even have been international, it was just national. But she said, I just saw that Pearson was looking for an instructional designer for a couple of history courses for the high school level. Why don't you try to do that work? I had done my doctoral work in education, in curriculum teaching and educational policy at Michigan State, but I'd never heard the term instructional designer. But heck, I was a teacher. I knew how to design instruction, right? And so I responded to the email that was listed. And within hours, I got a phone call from somebody at Pearson asking me to do this work. That was in October or so of 08. Mm-hmm. That ended in January of 09. And the people who worked at Pearson said to me, you know, we really liked working with you. We're going to call you back again. Well, in my mind, that was like the next week, 2 weeks later, the next month. By the time October came, I wasn't even thinking about it anymore. I knew that it had been a really nice thing to say and that she didn't mean it. And lo and behold, I got this email. I was sitting at a bagel store, going through my emails fast, and zipped through this one too. And then I said, wait a minute. What did that say? And I went back, and it was an offer to do some work.
Oh, nice.
Serendipitous, because yeah. If it had not been there, I don't think I'd ever be sitting here today.
It's interesting that, people always say like, oh, you know, I had this non-successful or failed company or failed experience, but that it's like all of those things worked to your current reality. So when you said the term, you know, non-successful, for those who, you know, for students and for people who are maybe not feeling successful right now, like what would you tell them, you know, like in terms of like all the things that you've gone through to get to where you are today?
Congratulations. And then I would explain to them that the reason that I'm congratulating them is because if they were sitting in front of the TV all day long or in front of the computer doing something all day long, they wouldn't feel like they'd failed. But they feel like they failed because they got up and tried something new. And then I would say, when you look at the real world outside of school, failure is actually a mark of distinction and honor. And the fact is, you want to fail fast and fail smart so that you learn from your losses. I'll give you an example. In 1992, I was a student at Columbia, but I also have a degree from the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is sort of like a Jewish university. I was in the undergraduate school, but the rabbinical school is one of the graduate schools. And when you're done, you become a rabbi. I wanted to be a rabbi, I thought, because I was in the community. And I applied to rabbinical school. And the committee told me to take a couple of years off, grow up, and come back. That was the best decision that anybody ever made for me. However, if you'd asked me a day or two later, or even a month or two later, or even a year later, I would still have been devastated. But I love my life now and would not have been happy as a rabbi. Okay. So somebody once told me that they applied for a job as a lawyer. They were a lawyer and they applied to a specific law firm and he didn't get the job. And I said to him, well, was that a good thing? And his response to me was, well, when you get rejected, it's never a good thing. I felt so bad for this guy because he just doesn't get it. You need to let rejections propel you to the next thing. And if you look at it that way, rejections can actually be really positive things.
Yeah, I like that. I was thinking maybe the lawyer would have said, I don't know yet. That would have been a great lawyer.
Yes. It depends.
Right, right. But no, I mean, yeah, this is, you know, in our previous conversations prior to the interview here, you know, one of the things that actually, I kind of digested in our conversation, took some notes and everything. And then, you know, here you are, you have this amazing company reaching thousands of entities and people associated with education. And, you know, there's curriculum build, there is obviously some assessment build and these types of things. You know, so this is a kind of a two-part question. The first thing is maybe kind of elaborate, like, what is the range of that do you put into play and that, you know, the APAS group does? And then, well, how do you, or maybe you have the secret sauce under there of how you can really help people learn exactly what you just said? Because I know students right now, when they take a test, if they don't even get an A on it, they think the whole thing is gone, right? Which you and I know that's not the case, but, you know, kind of take it from that perspective as well. So start with, like, what is the range of the things that you do? And then, yeah, how do you help people, educators even, learn those lessons that we just talked about?
I think those two questions are really quite different. So I'll answer each of them, if that's okay.
Sure.
APAS really exists because we believe that every student has the right to become a self-fulfilling individual who can make a positive contribution to society. And the way that we help students do that is by developing creatively engaging content. And I want to build the kind of content that makes students go, wow, make their eyes brighten. And we're not in the classroom. We're professional content development experts. So it's easier for us to spend the time that it takes to really add the excitement to it. And I want learners to really feel good about what they're learning. It needs to, in part, be about them. Because if it's not about them, if it doesn't speak to them, they're going to have very little interest in it. And most of these ideas came from when I was a teacher. I just loved exciting my students. I loved creating lessons that they wanted to talk about afterwards. I taught at a Jewish camp, actually. And these are normal kids who go to camp. I mean, they're far more interested in members of the opposite gender than they are in anything else. And they love the sports and the swimming, et cetera, et cetera. But they have to go to classes 2 hours a day. And we were learning about charity and the better ways of giving charity and the not such better ways of giving charity. And they ended up creating games about them, because that was the assignment, that was the activity. Went into their cabin, one of the group's cabins, later that afternoon, and they were sitting there playing their game. And that to me was like, wow, they're bringing class into the cabin with them. And I want to develop that kind of material for the students today. And for the second question, Peter, I wish I could say it's easy. I wish I could say that I had the automatic answer. But the challenge is, first of all, the school culture, for some reason, is that failure is a bad thing. 70 is horrible, even if this child used to get 30s. Or maybe it's horrible. And for the kid who maintains that 70 because they don't try to get anything better, it's the same 70 as somebody else. And it's just the culture of school. You're in school every day. I actually heard what Ali said at the beginning of the podcast and thought, that would be really interesting to get into school by being a sub once a month or something. Because in my role, I am the founder of a fairly large content development company, and yet I haven't been in a school in way too long, and I don't like that. So you may have a better answer than me, Peter, and you certainly have far more influence than me in teaching kids that failure can actually be a stepping stone and not an ending stone.
What's that answer, Ali?
I mean, the frontline teachers are, you know, they can be so influential. And in that mindset piece, you know, you can present all the content in the world. It can be as exciting as possible, but that mentorship and that relationship that you have with young people or young kids in the classroom, it's irreplaceable when it's genuine and the teacher's excited about the content and they are excited to deliver it to the students and can do so in a way that, you know, kind of takes it off the page and gets kids to think about it. You can't replace it. As the school year is starting and we're into the fall, you know, what are some things that you like to think about with your content and the company that you run that kind of like dives deeper than just maybe, you know, the straight academics, if your company does that? Like, I'm just curious because I know part of what we're really interested in this year is that social emotional component to learning. And, you know, like, how can we better reach students, not just with the hard facts, because they can access those so easily these days. You know, we have this digital, place that like has all the answers, but you know, that the interactions with humans and other people is like declining. So I'm really curious on your thoughts about that.
I frankly don't think that anything's more important than the social emotional learning, because I'm in the middle of reading a Brené Brown book, and it's called Daring Leadership. And it essentially talks about the fact that people put up armor around themselves. Mm. And it's designed to protect them. And I'm not the CEO of APAS anymore. I hired a CEO. And she asked me to read the book. And what I realized as I'm reading the book is that this inner voice that everybody has is really who they are. And when you put up this armor, you're ignoring your inner voice, ignoring your real needs. And instead of saying, I'm unhappy about something, for example, striking out at somebody else, because it's easier for me, Ali, to say that you did something wrong than for me to say, I'm really unhappy about something and I don't feel good. And I think that social and emotional learning helps the students and hopefully adults too, because we should always be learning this. Listen to their inner voices and grapple with that armor in the hope of tearing it down. And then people can connect in really meaningful ways. We obviously have a huge epidemic of shootings in American schools. And I really think that if people, teachers, other students, parents, knew how to listen to the kids' inner voices, who they really are, then a lot of these stressful situations would be eliminated. I'll give you just one example that I consider horrible. I live in West Bloomfield, Michigan, about 25 minutes away from Oxford, Michigan, where one of those shootings took place. And the kid who did the shooting literally called out for help. He asked his parents if he could see a therapist. He drew pictures that were just dark. Nobody helped him. And of course, this kid did the shooting. But we should have, going back to what you just said, Allie, the teacher is so powerful and influential, because we can't listen to the child or the teenager because we're not there. We can develop the resources, the tools to help the teacher and to help the students. And we do develop SEL tools and resources. But ultimately, it's one person speaking to another and being empathetic and listening.
It's really powerful. And it's very interesting. It takes a long time, I think, for a professional educator to start to to really realize that, coming from your traditional teacher education, right? And that's something that I wanted to ask you about before we kind of get into the big question of disrupt education. But now I've taught for 21 years, and I did go through teacher education early 2000s, right? So I think it was 2000, 2001. And they were still hammering down classroom management, and it's very different, right? Like, you know, you have got to don't smile until winter break and all these different things. Right. And that was still prevalent. Now I can't say, and maybe Ali, you can help me out here. You know, I'm going to guess you went to your teacher training a little bit after me, but it was always like that. And I've even seen kind of, different educational entities, groups, associations really are still in that mindset of it is authoritative, right? Very authoritative. Well, let me ask Allie this. So when you went through your training, did you see that, or was it starting to change in the social emotional? And then, you know, Andy, I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, should we be training differently that route? But what did you see, Allie?
I had a variety of experiences in my master's program, everything from shadowing teachers that were more in that authoritative dictatorship type mm-hmm. experience. And that is how they felt that they could control and, you know, like have the classroom operate in any kind of functional level, to, you know, a range where the students are creating the rules, and, you know, it's like more, I would say, like, just free flowing. There aren't so many rules. The teacher is like this guide, you know, it feels mm-hmm. very like such a range. But I would say in the books, you know, it would definitely be more like linear, you know, just mm-hmm. have these set of rules, have these clear expectations, don't bend on them. You know, everybody gets the same kind of treatment. You know, it felt more like a laundry list of do's and don'ts, and there didn't seem to be a lot of gray area. Okay. Social emotional components were there, but I wouldn't say that it was as outright as it could have been and should be. I really think that word phrase has become more popular or like more the mainstream, I would say in the last 5 years, especially after the pandemic.
Sure. Sure. So yeah. What are your thoughts on something like that, Andrew? Have you seen, I mean, you know, I'm guessing you work with a lot of different entities. I mean, we're in the classroom. There's so many different levels in education. What are you seeing towards the training and those types of things?
So I suspect I'm a little bit older than you, Peter.
2 years max.
Okay. So when I got my teaching certificate, it was really close to what Alan just described. And I'm guessing that when you got yours, it was also really close to what Alan just described. And I'm guessing that kids who get their teaching certificate today, it's really close to what Ali just described. And my point is that so little changes. And Dan Lordy was a sociologist at the University of Chicago. And he wrote a book called School Teacher, in which he explained that there was something called an apprenticeship of observation. By the time somebody becomes a teacher, they've sat in front of teachers for so long that they think they know what to do. And just do what your own teachers did. And it's just self-perpetuating. By the way, there's one other job that I've identified that is a lot like that, where you think you know how to do it, even though you may have no idea. Can either of you guess what that other job is?
I'm going to have to guess politics, but I'm a little skewed.
Allie?
A taxi driver?
That works. Mine is restaurant owner.
Oh,
because you sit in a. So my point is that such little changes. And I knew a young man. He might have been connected to me, but I might get shot if I was more specific as to who this young man was or is. And he was in school and didn't do so well. And he's now 28. When he was about 15, 14, I said, it's too bad he's not 10 years younger. Because if he was 10 years younger, he would have been extremely successful. And the reason he would have been extremely successful is because I said everything would be individualized by then, by what he got to school. And this young man, absolutely, as a teenager, loved video games. Could play video games nonstop. I said by the time if he was 10 years younger, by the time he got to school, he could learn everything through video games. That's just not the case. So much of it continues to perpetuate what was. And I realized that. And if APAS Educational Group can do one thing to disrupt ed, what I want to do is work with organizations and leaders who really want to take the core of schooling, which is teaching and learning, and make it more powerful for each individual student. Our business is all about the student. We have a 10-year goal where we want to engage 100 million students in either content that we've developed or helped to develop. And I think we'll get there. But it's not about us. It's not about the principals. It's about the learner.
One thing that, you know, I'm hearing you say a lot is customized. And it's funny, you go back into the video game, my mind is bouncing all over the place. My brother is a very successful video game designer because he just played a lot of video games. He was in sports and such as well. And I kind of took his lesson in I teach business. So I have a little bit of an advantage, possibly over a science teacher over here or a mathematics teacher or whatever. However, there are ways, and Allie's obviously talked about different ways that she's brought in, you know, very kind of self-driven and interest into a science classroom. One of the things that I like to do, and I kind of wanted to pick your brain on this a little bit, was, you know, do students actually have a chance to create curriculum within? Is that something that you look at? You know, as you're creating a lesson, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I used to have the books when I was a kid that were, you know, choose your own path, right? Is that what it's looking like these days, and how students can, you know, obviously use different tools? Could be technology, it could be a maze. Who knows what it is? But like, is that what that's looking like? Because I'm interested in that. I love that stuff.
I think that stuff is really neat. As mm-hmm. far as I know, and I don't know every project that we're working on.
Sure.
Because, I mean, it's just not my lane.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen very many projects like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the traditional down the lane centered content.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that I fully agree that students should have the ability to pick and choose. And, excuse me, that's extremely empowering and giving them agency. And if they don't have agency, they're not going to be interested. And when we develop content, we try very hard, even if it's centered, to give them opportunities to use their own thoughts to empower them.
I think that's you're going to have to, any kind of company, any kind of partnership with schools, it's going to have to be more and more like, how does it connect to the individual student and what they're going through and how do they relate to it in order to have like the deeper connections than just like, oh, you know, the basic math facts or geography or English lessons, any kind of content, because it's so accessible, right? So then it's like, well, what's in it for me? What's in it for the learner? All of that. I can totally see that being a huge, important piece in anybody developing any kind of content or curriculum or learning experience for schools inside the system, outside the system, et cetera. And so I think you kind of hit on this a little bit in an earlier answer, but I want you to imagine that you're speaking to school leaders and educators and students, whatever level that you want to kind of choose this, or all of them, up to you. You have an answer you want to give here, but you know, like, how do you want to change kind of the school system, and what would that look like at the level that you pick to kind of disrupt education?
I think the big word there is imagination. I want everybody in the school system to imagine how things could be and share their thoughts with other stakeholders and together collaborate and rumble so that they can come up with the best ideas possible and give different ideas different times so that different ideas can shine through and really be empowering. Because that's far more important than learning anything specific in the age of Google and ChatGPT. And the more imagination, the more problems arise, which is good, because the more problems that arise, the more problem solving that can be done. And that's what it's all about. Picking an ideal as to what you want it to look like. Seeing the challenges towards getting to that ideal. And then determining how to overcome those challenges. I myself, whenever I'm in a situation where it's hard for me to get out of, stop for a moment and say, hey, Andy, how can I get myself out of this? Whether it's a technological problem or something on the road or just anything. And the more kids, even adults, can learn to problem solve so that they can reach their ideals, the better off we'll be. So I wrote an article recently in which I said, too often kids are getting up in the morning expecting to be bored. And we have to stop that. And too often teachers are going to school thinking that they can't do anything about their situation. We have to stop that. And I think that that will really make society a healthier, more productive place, and people will certainly feel more fulfilled.
So I took number one, thank you for identifying imagination, because I don't know if you saw Ali and I, and if you're watching on YouTube, you can rewind there, because we were like, ooh. So, but I think that, you know, one of the biggest challenges, which I love, is when a challenge comes forward to, there's a blocker in an innovative idea. The 10 to, and I'm not saying everybody, because we know great, Ali and I have talked to great, you know, administrators and educational people, and I'm sure you have too, Andy. But like, they see that and they're like, well, it's easier to maintain, right? That right there, you get to that point of the cliff and you're just like, this could be big, like very big. And not in a negative way, but a big impact on more and more students, more and more of the learning community. And I think what you said there is very interesting. And now I'm thinking of like different ways to what if and how to get around those challenges. How do I get out of this? How do I get to this? I love that thought process. So that's wonderful. Before we get to your information here and wrap up, I'm like, now, see, you're so good at what you do, Andy. Like, we're thinking about things here we're learning, but that was kind of my final thought. But Ali, what kind of final thoughts are you going to take from this amazing podcast before we get Andy's connection information and such?
Really great thoughts throughout. So much to kind of dive into here. What I think with the piece with imagination that I'm going to take away here is, and tied in with this thought that you shared earlier about how everyone thinks they know what it takes to be a school teacher, or be in education today. And that can limit the imagination of where education can go and how to disrupt it. And so I just want to encourage anyone listening to this podcast to, you know, really paint outside the lines, reimagine things completely differently. The core of teaching and learning can still be there, but how it looks, how it's shaped, how it's done can be totally different if you allow for that imagination. And then with what you said, Peter, you're going to have to jump off the cliff. You're going to have to just like take the leap, and it's going to be messy, and there's going to be conflict, and there's going to be issues, but it's empowering. And that's how you solve more problems, by creating them, honestly, and failing. So just to tie it all back together.
Right.
I have one question for you, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, I don't get enough of an opportunity to interact with students in real schools. You're in Chicago, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So can we, if the answer is no, that's totally fine also.
I'll even say yes right now. I know what you're going to ask. Yeah.
I would so love to come and talk to your students and like just work with you for a day and interact and see real students at a real school.
Mm-hmm. 100%. This is the way we do it on Disrupt Education. Yeah, 100%. And I think that you would bring so much amazing information to our youth and just being in front of them. And we're going to set that up.
I would love to.
But with that being said, other people may want to connect and say, hey, Andy, come to our school. How do people connect with you and APAS?
First of all, I'd love to come to people's schools. And the best way to reach out to me is andrew.pass@apasseducation.com. And if they want to go to our website, it's apasseducation.com.
Excellent. We'll put all of that up in the notes as well. So you can just click and bounce and see what Andy's doing. Wow. I can't thank you enough for sharing, you know, your insight, your journey. It's great because I felt like this was just a conversation that was flowing. It was, and that's just what learning is. It's always flowing and moving. And, you know, the imagination, you gave us a lot to think about. You gave a couple of great two books there. If you don't mind saying both of those again, you're reading, what is the leadership book? And then the one from University of Chicago.
I'm reading Brené Brown, Daring Leadership.
Okay.
And Brené Brown has written a whole bunch of books.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Dan Lordy's book was actually from the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called School Teacher.
Nice. Yeah, we'll definitely link those up down below as well. So I want to thank everybody for hanging out with us. Andrew, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and knowledge. And definitely go check out his website and connect with him. For Allie Privet, I'm Peter Hostrasser. Thank you all for listening to the Disrupt Education Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of the Disrupt Education Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Are you ready to disrupt the educational arena you're a part of? For more ways to get involved in the work we do here at Disrupt Education, check us out at disrupteducation.co or find us on LinkedIn at Peter Hostrasser or Allie Privet.
Our mission here is to help facilitate and amplify changes in the educational system through local initiatives and help you scale them into community movements. Our building network of disruptors in education are working to move beyond scores and grades as the only measure for student learning. If your school district, college campus, or organization is looking for facilitators of this work, reach out on our website or social media.
And if you have any thoughts or feedback on this week's episode or any episode, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries, taking risks, and most importantly, disrupting education.
Hey, it's Peter Hostrasser here. And hey, I want to tell you something about how I am actually disrupting education. Yeah, I'm moving forward with portfolios on spikeview.com. If you head over to spikeview.com, basically what we're teaching our students to do is actually to create a skills-based portfolio around their interests, their passions, and what they're good at. It's called the strength-based approach. So basically what we do is we build up our students and have them understand what they're good at and what they're interested in by the time they leave our high school. But it doesn't stop there. It's a K through grade. So if you want your students to continue to build their strengths in this day and age where resumes are dying and to show more and more about who they are, what they do, and they actually control all the data behind it, guess what? SpikeView is the place for you. Head over to spikeview.com, check it out. Let me know if you need anything, because I tell you what, I have used this with my own family and my students. Check out spikeview.com today.